Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. The Marcellus Shale natural gas boom has increased the household incomes of thousands of Pennsylvanians over the past 10 years. In fact, many have used their newfound money to remodel their homes or farms, buy new equipment, pay for college for their children, or splurge on new boats or pickup trucks. But not all landowners who have gas wells on their properties have made a lot of money, and those who haven't seen the big royalty checks are crying foul, and some have even gone to court against gas companies. State Impact Pennsylvania has reported on this issue before, but not a lot has been done to change it over the last few years. Joining us for an update today is State Impact Pennsylvania reporters Marie Cusick and Amy Sisk. Marie and Amy, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. I want to play a cut here, or a clip, sound clip from Jim Barrett. This is a landowner in northeastern Pennsylvania in Bradford County, and just a quick little snippet from him.
It's thievery. No doubt about it.
All right, Marie Cusick, you talked to Jim Barrett. He's talking about the gas wells on his land. I believe you reported that he has four on his farm, but he's not seeing a lot of money from those gas wells. Why not?
Yeah, well, Jim Barrett is a landowner. He's a farmer up in Bradford County, and he actually has made a lot of money from the natural gas industry. But what he's saying here is that they're taking his gas and they're not paying him properly for it. What he compared it to was, you know, he has a forest on his land that if somebody were to come in and cut down the trees and drag them away and not pay him, he has a big problem with that. So over the years, he has made quite a bit of money, and he's quite happy that the gas industry is in town. He says it's helped keep the region alive, but he also feels like he's really being shortchanged and that the company that he's leased to is taking gas that's his and not paying him for it.
So why does he feel he's being shortchanged?
Well, the crux of this issue is something called post-production costs, which are the expenses. It's expensive to move the gas from the well to consumers. There's pipelines, there's dehydration, there's compression. It costs money to move the gas. So a lot of what landowners have been saying is that these costs, these expenses, these post-production costs are being deducted from their monthly royalty checks in an inappropriate way. At times, they feel like they're exorbitant and they're not well accounted for, and this is a poorly regulated realm of the oil and gas industry. So at times, some people feel that they're really being left with almost nothing because all these expenses are being withheld from their income.
So you say that Jim Barrett has made a lot of money over the years, but in the story that you and Amy wrote last week, reported on last week, you said that he questions whether he can hand his farm down to his sons because he doesn't know whether he can afford to keep doing it.
Yeah, he said farming is really a very capital-intensive endeavor, and that he says they're doing okay. He's not complaining about his financial situation, but that if he and his wife were to need to retire, they would essentially have to sell their farm. They don't really have a big nest egg. So what he's saying is if he'd gotten this money that he feels he's owed from the gas on his property, then they would have this nest egg that would be in the bank, and he would be able to feel more security that he could hand his farm down to his sons and grandkids.
You also spoke with Charlie Clark, and he's in Susquehanna County, one county over in the north central region of Pennsylvania. He described natural gas drilling on his property as hitting the lottery. He doesn't seem to have these problems. Why?
No, he's very happy, and he does feel like he hit the lottery, and he does have the same kind of post-production costs deducted from his monthly checks, although he feels they're reasonable. That's something else we tried to show, that there's just a high degree of variability in what people are receiving. He says he receives about $10,000 a month, from two wells on his property, and he has four kids and all their colleges paid for, and he's been able to buy new equipment for his farm, new hunting gear. He loves to hunt. hunt. He told me he's going to a big hunting trip in South Africa this summer. So he's quite pleased with the amount of money he's getting and the way he feels like these post-production costs to him are reasonable. So both men are happy that the gas industry's there. They've said it's done a lot for the economy, but they just live, you know, about 40 miles apart, and one feels like these post-production costs are exorbitant and inappropriate, and the other feels like it's fine.
All right, you would think that this is something that would have been negotiated right up front, that the property owners would have been aware that there was a possibility of post-production cost and have been given some sense of what it would be, how much it would cost. But that doesn't appear to be happening all the time. I think what you and Amy did in this story, it's a good comparison that, you know, just 40 miles apart, you have two farmers who have completely different experiences. One happy with and you know, with the situation, how much money he's getting, and not unsatisfied with how much money is being taken out post-production cost. The other possibly going to court over these post-production costs. How can that be?
Well, you're right. There was a real, I'd say, lack of legal advice, lack of understanding about how the oil and gas industry works in Pennsylvania, even though Pennsylvania is home to the first commercially drilled oil well in the world. And really, the global oil boom started in Pennsylvania. For much of its history recently, it moved elsewhere and people weren't dealing with this. So yes, you have the problem of people, when they were signing these leases with gas companies, not understanding what all this stuff meant. But also, there were cases where people actually were informed and did have clauses saying, hey, you can't deduct all these post-production expenses. It explicitly says that you can't. Or maybe they negotiated, okay, you can deduct this, but not that. But in many cases, some of what these lawsuits are alleging is that it's just being done anyway, and it's just being done in a very non-transparent way. And it's really hard for people to figure out what the heck is going on.
I think one other important point to add is I think a lot of people receive their royalties checks and they can't make heads or tails of it, especially when it comes to these deductions and why these specific deductions were taken out. It's just a lot of numbers and it doesn't make a lot of sense to, you know, your average person who owns minerals.
Well, Amy, let's talk about that a little bit. Marie has talked about post-production costs. Drill down into that. Oh, there's a poor choice of words. drill down into that a little bit more. What constitutes post-production cost?
Yeah, so when gas is extracted from the ground, there's not really a price that you can pinpoint to that gas. It doesn't have a lot of value at that exact moment because, as Marie said, it has to go through a network of pipelines and then processing facilities in order to get to market. And so the transportation and the processing of that gas essentially is adding value, and it gets to the point then where the natural gas company can sell the gas to somebody who will actually get it to consumers, you know, to you and me, to whoever is using that gas. And so the issue is that on a lot of people's leases, there's a stipulation that they should be paid for the value of their gas at the wellhead, so at the well when it's coming up. But because there's not really a price that you can pinpoint to the gas at that exact moment, you have to then subtract those post-production costs, the costs of getting the gas through the pipelines, through the processing facilities, to come up with that cost, and that's why those deductions are there.
So, Amy, you kind of looked at the big picture on this. You used to work or cover energy in North Dakota, and we're going to talk about you know, some of the pipelines out in that area as well. Mm-hmm. But this is not just an issue in Pennsylvania, is it?
No, it's not. And so that's one thing that I was curious about, because when I was a reporter in North Dakota, I wasn't aware of this issue there, but it got me curious, you know, are landowners across the country experiencing similar issues to landowners here in Pennsylvania? So actually one of my first calls that I did in reporting this story was to a lawyer in North Dakota to talk with him about this. And what I learned was this actually is an issue in North Dakota, but it's a relatively new issue that folks there didn't start to complain about until about a year and a half ago. And this was the case in a lot of places, as I found out, throughout the country. And what happened was And states like North Dakota, North Dakota is an oil state, and so there's a small amount of natural gas that comes up along with the oil, but mainly people are receiving royalties based on oil, and a small amount of royalties based on the natural gas that comes up. Well, what happened is the price of oil and the price of gas tanked. Starting in 2014 and continued through 2015, 2016, we're just now seeing prices start to recover. And when those prices tanked, people's royalties checks shrank. But they were still, these post-production costs to transport and process the gas were still being taken out of their royalties checks. So suddenly those deductions were taking up a greater percentage of people's checks, and people were noticing it for the first time. And so that's when you started to see a lot of complaints roll in places like North Dakota, places like Texas, other oil and gas states across the country.
You know, what you're describing, and Marie, you can weigh in on this too, but what you're describing sounds as if, okay, when the price goes down, supply and demand, simple economics, it would make sense that the royalty checks would not be as big as what they were when the price of natural gas or in oil in North Dakota's case was higher. But it sounds as if the companies that are drilling don't want to take a bigger loss, so they're doing it on the backs of those that own the land. Marie, would that be accurate?
Well, that's one of the accusations, that in some cases these costs are not real costs. They're just inflated in order to help boost the company's bottom line. I'll also say that royalty checks, I've heard them called mailbox money, in that it's sort of money that falls out of the sky. You don't have to do anything for it, or you don't have to do much other than sign a lease and maybe put up with some development on your land. So as Amy pointed out, when prices were high and people were getting these big checks and times were good, there may have been some deductions on the check, but you weren't really thinking about it or noticing it until the price of gas and oil tanked, and then suddenly you're getting less money, and suddenly you see bigger deductions, or you're just trying to understand what's going on, and it's really not very transparent or well-regulated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that, sometimes the deductions that are taken out of people's checks are reasonable, as is the case with Charlie Clark, who Marie interviewed for the story that we did. But one of the things that became clear to me when I was talking with this lawyer from North Dakota was the fact that, very often these costs just are unreasonable. And an example that he gave to me was he had a lot of clients, landowners, who called him to complain about the fact that the deductions that companies in North Dakota were suddenly taking out of the checks dated back retroactively to, say, 2012, 2013. And kind of the excuse that the companies were giving to this lawyer when he was calling them to inquire about why they were doing this is, well, we should have been taking out these deductions all along, and so now we're going to retroactively take them out of people's checks. And this happened when prices tanked, of course, and companies were not making the kinds of profits that they used to.
Wow. I don't know if a lot of bills that you receive in the mail that charge you for something retroactively, that's a little bit unique. We're going to take some phone calls and some emails here in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about a State Impact Pennsylvania report by Amy Sisk and Marie Cusick. And by the way, you can read that report on WITF.org. Go to State Impact Pennsylvania. That reports on the controversy over royalty payments to those landowners that have natural gas drilling sites on their land. Some are very happy with it, have made a lot of money. Others still made some money, but not quite as happy with what they're getting in their checks, and it's attributed partly to what's called post-production cost. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. We're going to take some phone calls in just a moment. But before we do, I want to hear from one of those landowners that Marie spoke to.
I guess I really don't understand why the government hasn't stepped in and done just a little bit more, because I think it would benefit them too. Any extra money that we would get, we would be taxed on?
That is Charlie Clark, and that was the landowner, Marie, that you said was getting about $10,000 a month and was, you know, he called it hitting the lottery, and he said he was happy with what he was getting in his royalty payments. But the point he makes about government stepping in, why hasn't government stepped in here?
Yeah, Charlie was very happy with the money he was receiving, but he's well aware some of his neighbors have had a lot of problems dealing with post-production costs. He feels like it is unfairly doled out, and there have been many efforts. I think we're on our third iteration of a bill that attempts to address this and update a decades-old Pennsylvania law that guarantees mineral owners at least a 12.5% of oil and gas revenue. So why hasn't anything been done? I don't really know. There's bipartisan consensus that there's a problem. I think the gas industry seriously opposes and has lobbied aggressively against these bills. They argue that they would impair contracts and that these are contracts that have been signed and the legislature can't just swoop in and rewrite contracts. So it's been a fight for years, and really these bills have gone virtually nowhere.
So just to point out something that Amy said a few minutes ago, the gas companies are saying that government, the legislature, cannot step in, rewrite contracts, but yet the companies can retroactively charge post-production cost.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty thorny fight, and the advocates for the mineral owners say, well, hey, legislature, you've actually stepped in and changed the law that changes our contracts in other ways that they feel like favors the gas industry. So really, I think there is a 1979 law on the books in Pennsylvania that says oil and gas companies have to give mineral owners at least a 12.5%. And what many people are saying is because these post-production costs are so high and there's so many deductions, they're really not receiving that minimum, that floor. So that's what this is about, really. Is there a way legally to sort of restore that floor? And so far, there's been no consensus, although, as I said, there is bipartisan agreement that there's a real problem.
Let's take a phone call from John in Lewisburg. John, I understand that you're a landowner and that you do receive royalties, right?
That is correct. And I think there's several points that you're missing at this point. Amy talks about the deductions, but the deductions assume that we are a partner in the well production, and we are not. So that's number one. Number two, the legislature can clarify the language on so that, and they do this consistently, they clarify language on contracts, and they define terms. And the term of wellhead price would solve a huge amount of this. Finally, the state loses, and this is from calculations I have presented to legislature, by not dealing with the royalty issue by clarifying the language, they lose over $120 million a year in taxes. And that is not what is lost by DCNR and the Game Commission in their royalties, because they're also paying these same deductions.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you before you get away, John, are you satisfied with the royalties that you've been paid?
No, because I have a no deductions clause in my lease, and those are not being honored.
Okay, that when you say your lease, meaning there is a contract, and I was going to ask both Marie and Amy about this as well. Is there anything that landowners can do to prevent deductions? You have in your lease that the deductions are not supposed to be made, correct?
That is absolutely correct, and it clearly states that for what purposes those deductions can be made. This case, along with many others, is courts at this point, and that's all that I can do.
Thank you very much for your call, John, and weighing in. Marie and Amy, let's talk about that, because that was one of the questions that I had for you, the two of you. Is there anything that landowners can do to prevent deductions? It sounds like John actually looked into that or had it written in, but it's still happening.
Yeah, I think that John echoes a lot of the concerns of landowners across the country that are dealing with this, because there's not a whole lot that folks can do. Often, you know, if a landowner feels that they're being cheated out of, you know, money that they should be paid in the form of royalties, they can hire, you know, an expert to audit their royalties checks, and if they're indeed being cheated out of money, they could, you know, hire a lawyer to sue their gas company, or, you know, enter into a class action lawsuit. There have been several class action lawsuits across the country dealing with this. But really the main recourse that landowners go through to try to recover some of that money is to take the matter to court. Now, I would say that there are efforts underway by groups that represent landowners and mineral owners to try to better educate landowners so that they don't sign leases that either have unclear, fuzzy language or leases that aren't going to work in their favor. But once you've signed that lease and if deductions are being taken out, it can be a struggle for a lot of landowners.
Now, Amy, you used the word cheated out of their royalties. I'm going to make sure that we're clear here. Post-production costs, are these legitimate costs, or don't landowners know just because they're not transparent?
I mean, sometimes the costs are definitely legitimate, and you know, landowners feel that they're reasonable. The issue is when landowners can't make heads or tails of exorbitant deductions that companies are taking out of their royalties checks without, you know, explaining exactly what accounts for those deductions. That's when we get into this issue of landowners often feeling cheated out of money that they feel they should be owed.
And Scott, I'll add just, there's one, you know, an even more fundamental issue I've heard a lot of people talk about is that the production numbers themselves, which is how much gas are you producing from my property, there's really no way to know for sure. And people have complained that that is also poorly regulated because the companies really just, they self-report it to the state. And in the past, the State Department of Environmental Protection, which sort of houses all this information. I mean, there have been massive errors and problems. If you go look at that production data, sometimes I've looked at it and there's just large companies completely missing from the data set. And I call and say, hey, what happened to EQT? Don't they still work here? And they said, oh, it was just, you know, full of errors and they are fixing it. Or one time, one of the large companies just submitted such error-ridden data to the state. The state's computer system rejected it and it threw off the entire production totals of natural gas for Pennsylvania, which really, you know, affects people on Wall Street. It affects government regulators, people just trying to simply understand how much gas is being produced. That's really not audited or checked in any way.
Well, let me interrupt for just a moment. So are you saying that this is not monitored in a meaningful way?
It is checked, actually. I misspoke. DEP told me they do have somebody who looks over the numbers, but no, it's not verified.
It's not verified by the state?
No, although the state, when we're talking about leases on state land, state forest land, and they actually had to hire a new person a few years ago. Just their full-time job is dealing with this because the state itself is having these problems, and their leases say you can't take out these deductions, and they're having to haggle with companies over why are you deducting this and that, and how much did you produce? And they have a contract with Penn State and some people who go out and actually verify the meters. But for the regular person, no, there's really no way to even know how much gas is being produced, which is a sort of more fundamental problem.
We have a question from a listener who asked, do Marie or Amy know how the state taxes the royalty payments? Are those who are getting $10,000 a month, like Charlie Clark, for example, paying state income at a rate of 3.07% of $10,000, which is the personal income tax rate?
Yes, they're paying income tax on it. As I understand it, I'm not a mineral owner, but you essentially get like a 1099 at the end of the year, and this is the extra income you receive. So that's what some people say, is that, hey, if you made sure, if everyone was making sure that all the I's were dotted and the T's were crossed and everyone was being paid appropriately, the state would be pulling in more revenue because people would be paying taxes on it.
So as John said, the caller just a few minutes ago, and as you just pointed out, I mean, you would think the legislature would have motivation to, you know, make this, come up with a little stricter law on
this.
Yeah,
you would think that because they sort of need money.
Yeah, sort of, yeah.
Sort of, yeah.
Do we know how much money the state could... I mean, because it just sounds like there's so many things that we don't know that we probably don't know how much money we're losing.
People have thrown out various numbers. I think John threw out $120 million. It's almost impossible to know for sure because there's so many thousands of different people, different mineral owners, different leases. So it's quite difficult to try to calculate sort of what is missing here and what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. But I think it's fair to say it's a substantial amount of money.
Amy, you touched on this a little bit earlier, but what are landowners doing in Pennsylvania?
Landowners, one of the things, there's a national group that represents royalty owners, the National Association of Royalty Owners, and they realized a couple years ago when price of gas was tanking and people were starting to complain more and more about these deductions being taken out of their royalty checks, that they needed to do something to try to better educate landowners. They're a group, they have a chapter here in Pennsylvania. They're creating kind of a seminar for landowners to go through at various conferences that they might attend in their various states to learn about these issues and how they're playing out in their states. So that's one thing that's taking place here. And then as Marie had mentioned, of course, you know, there have been several efforts over the years to try to pass legislation to address this.
This sounds like something, and I don't know how often it occurs, but it sounds like something that many of these landowners should maybe have gotten an attorney to read over a contract they were going to sign. Has that happened a lot?
Yeah, you know, that's something that I heard time and time again in interviewing various lawyers who represent mineral owners in these negotiations, is that so often, especially early on in the shale boom, landowners were presented a lease by an oil and gas company and just, you know, signed it without negotiating the terms, or maybe did try to negotiate the terms, but maybe the language just wasn't super explicit in their lease and it did leave room for deductions. Or, you know, as John on the caller mentioned, you know, his lease specifically prohibits deductions, or so he thinks, but companies still tried anyway to take out those deductions. So there's certainly things that landowners can do in negotiating their leases to try to change the language to make sure that they're protected, but sometimes there's still disputes that can arise.
Marie?
I'll say, too, one thing many people have told me, Pennsylvania is unique in that it has this guaranteed minimum royalty act, so you're guaranteed as a mineral owner to receive at least a 12.5% royalty. So many people said that when they were approached by companies, the landmen said, hey, look, you're going to be fine because, you know, this is the legal floor. We have to give you at least 12.5%. And people are like, hey, that sounds great. And it is a 1979 state law that's on the books. So that's part of what the Attorney General lawsuit is about over this issue, is that there really was...
Okay, you mentioned Attorney General. What lawsuit?
There's several class action private lawsuits, but there's also a lawsuit that's been filed by the state. It was filed in late 2015 by former Attorney General Kathleen Kane, and current Attorney General Josh Shapiro is continuing it. It's really saying that there was a violation of Pennsylvania's unfair trade practices law, deceptive marketing. This is almost sort of like some of those consumer lawsuits we hear about where there was just there's sort of bad faith being accused here.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask Amy about the Russians in just a moment. But Marie, where do we go with this issue in just a moment? And people are probably wondering, what do the Russians have to do with this? But she'll explain.
I'll let Amy take the Russians. Well, where we are is we're on, I think it's the third iteration of a bill that's been stalled for years to try to clarify the Guaranteed Minimum Royalty Act, that 1979 law I mentioned, and then these lawsuits are still just making their way through the courts.
Hmm. So, Amy, that tease I just had there, and that's what we call it in the business, by the way, is a tease.
Great segue.
Is that we had mentioned earlier that you had covered energy in North Dakota, but just a while ago, a few weeks ago.
A couple days ago,
you saw a photograph that looked pretty familiar to you. Turns out that it was something that you had a photograph that you had taken, and there was an article. Well, I'll let you explain it. You probably do a much better job than I. Explain what happened.
Sure. This is one of the crazier things that has happened to me as a journalist. So last week, I was reading through an article that I saw in the Washington Post about this. The Russian trolls who apparently were using social media to try to manipulate the presidential election in 2016. The same group of Russian trolls was also using social media to try to influence the debate over energy in the United States. And there's a congressional report that came out last week about this, and this is what the Washington Post article was about. I was reading through this article because it was interesting to me because one of the issues that the trolls were targeting specifically with regard to energy was the Dakota Access Pipeline protests. And being a reporter in North Dakota at the time, I ended up covering those protests for about 8 months. And so I'm reading through this article. There's a number of social media posts that the article sort of reprinted. And as I'm looking through those posts, you know, and photos of the protests, all of a sudden I see one that looks really familiar. And I did a double take and like, wow, that is my photo. So a photo that I took at the protest camps ended up in this congressional report because these Russian trolls stole it, turned it into a meme that was actually critical of the pipeline protesters and spread it around on Instagram trying to influence the debate over the pipeline protests in the country. So not something you ever expect to happen to you, to have one of your photos end up in a congressional report that has to do with the Russia investigations, but that's what happened.
Yeah, that has to be a surprise, and I can understand that you've never experienced anything like that before, but kind of brings it home, doesn't it, of the world we live in today, doesn't it?
It does. You know, once your content is out there online, you know, even though people aren't supposed to steal it, people do, and they can use it for whatever agenda they see fit, and that's what happened in this case.
State Impact Pennsylvania reporters Marie Cusick and Amy Sisk, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks,
thank
Scott.
You.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among WITF, WHYY, WESA, and the Allegheny Front to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy. To learn more, visit WITF.org and click on State Impact Pennsylvania. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Forbes.com, part of Forbes magazine, has named Lancaster as one of the 10 coolest U.S. cities to visit in 2018. Lancaster is on a list that includes Savannah, Georgia, Portland, Maine, and San Antonio, Texas. The article asks high-end travel designers where they would send their clients domestically, and Lancaster's restaurants, arts, and history made it a top 10 destination. Joining us to discuss Lancaster's designation as a top 10 place to visit in the U.S. is Kathleen Frankford, who is president of Discover Lancaster. Ms. Frankford, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You know, these kind of lists are made all the time. Sometimes they don't have a lot of good information behind it, but this one apparently does. I mean, when you're asking travel designers out there, cities that a lot of people don't know about from around the country. So the reaction from an organization that promotes tourism and visitation in Lancaster and Lancaster County when you heard about this?
Well, we're beyond thrilled. And it's interesting because we just went through our strategic planning process and our vision is to be a top tier small destination in the U.S. And as we were talking about it, we said we want to be on these lists because we can be in the same company as the Charlestons, the Portland Maines, the Savannahs. We have that great eclectic mix of offerings that these other destinations have. So it's just interesting that we just finalized our vision and then this came out and we're like, this is our vision and this is what Lancaster is all about. So it's pretty incredible.
By the way, if you haven't read what Forbes.com had to say about Lancaster and the other cities on the list, there's a link on our website, WITF.org, today's description of Smart Talk. Let me read to you the text from Forbes.com. Lancaster, Pennsylvania, this newly hip Victorian city just 3 hours from New York City, is still one of the U.S.'s best-kept secrets. The center of Amish country is bucolic, but boasts a bustling food scene and is quickly becoming a cultural hotbed. Mm-hmm. The architecture is the real star, so explore the alleys and cobblestone streets by foot, checking out the many repurposed old warehouses that house thriving businesses, such as the Thistle Finch Distillery for cocktails and the Fridge for well-curated beers. The culinary star is Luca, quickly gaining national acclaim for its Italian dishes that pay homage to local farming communities. The arts are central to Lancaster's growth, notably the stunning Fulton Theater and neighboring Gathering Print Street, Lancaster's Gallery Row, which pulses with art on summer First Fridays. And, of course, First Friday in Lancaster is all year round, not just on summer. What sticks out to you about the things that that the Forbes had to say?
Nothing surprises me. I'm glad that the arts is getting recognition because we are a wonderful arts destination, and I know that the Fulton has gotten a lot of press over the past several years, so it's good to see that. But these restaurants are no surprise because we continue to get a lot of media coverage about our dining options. And, you know, at one time we were known just for the Amish cuisine, and we still are, and we have a lot of great larger properties that really are attractions in and of themselves. The Shady Maples, those types of attractions just continue to bring in so many different diners who want that type of experience. But now we're getting recognition for this fine dining that is growing in the city of Lancaster and in Lititz and even around the county. So it's really exciting because as we've talked to visitors and potential visitors, these are the things that they want. They want a varied experience. They want to be able to experience the Amish dining, and then they want to be able to go down in the city, have a wonderful cocktail, and have something very, very different.
I was thinking back to the last time you were on our program, and I introduced you, I believe, as being with the Pennsylvania Dutch mm-hmm. and Visitors Bureau.
Yes.
And now you're with Discover Lancaster.
Yes.
And it's the same organization, just mm-hmm. a different name, but that goes into the whole marketing campaign here for Lancaster and for Lancaster County. Tell me why.
Discover Lancaster states our mission. We've done a lot of research over the past several years to determine why people visit Lancaster and why people don't visit Lancaster. We're known for the Amish all over the world. And that is a big draw. And the people who come to Lancaster for the Amish love that experience. And they come several times a year. You also have a different a group of potential visitors who are intrigued by the Amish, but that may not be enough to bring them to the destination. So when they learn about the outdoor resources, the thriving city, our towns and villages, our dining, the arts, history, architecture, they're very intrigued and they're very interested to visit. So we went from Pennsylvania Dutch Convention and Visitors Bureau. It's a bit of a mouthful, and it also pigeonholes us to just one special thing about our destination when we have many special things. So we evolved to Discover Lancaster, and really that states our mission. We want people to come in and experience what they expect out of Lancaster, the Amish, the family-style dining, the outlets, and to experience the unexpected elements that are growing in awareness as evidenced by this piece and several other PR pieces that are media pieces that we've gotten over the past several years.
As you've explained, there's a lot of research that goes mm-hmm. into this. America, Pennsylvania, Lancaster County, the areas around Lancaster County, probably where your clientele come from, but the age group in which your clientele comes from, those changing demographics probably have a lot to do with switching from an emphasis on Pennsylvania Dutch, Amish, to what you're doing now.
Well, we're not switching the emphasis. We're just broadening the emphasis.
Okay, I'll use the word broadening.
Yes, because when you think about Lancaster, you know, you think Amish, you think family fun, and we know we're a big family destination, and you think, you know, thriving city. And those are really three of the big pillars of our destination. So, yes, when you look at the younger generations, the millennials, even the Gen Xers, obviously, they don't want the same thing that baby boomers want. So they want a varied experience. They want to interact with the Amish, with locals. They want high-end motels. They want a varied dining experience. They want outdoor resources. So they want to do a little bit of everything. So they might come out, they might do some of the Amish attractions one day, but then the next day, they want to go explore. So maybe they want to go throughout the county, visit some of our towns and villages, and some of, like, Columbia, Lititz, they're really growing in popularity and becoming like a small Lancaster city, more or less. But those are the things that they're interested in doing. They want to visit Central Market. They want to go to Gallery Row in downtown Lancaster. They want to go to some of the fine dining opportunities in the city. And they also want to have some nightlife. So those are things that really appeal to them. And that's going to draw them in to experience not only all of these quote unquote new offerings, but all of the traditional offerings as well.
So when Forbes.com is talking about Lancaster, Pennsylvania, they're not just talking about the city?
That's a good question. I think they are specifically talking about the city. When we talk about Lancaster, we're talking about the entire destination. The city is really the heart of our destination, just like it is, with any destination, Portland, Maine, Charleston, you've got the city. But then as you broaden out to other parts of the destination, that's what makes it special. So it's that blend of all of these different things that really lend to the uniqueness of Lancaster.
Mm-hmm. Those other cities, Philadelphia, by the way, is on that yes. list too. Mm-hmm. But, cities that are comparable in size, maybe a little bit bigger in population to Lancaster, like Savannah, like Portland, San Antonio, much bigger. But San Antonio is one of those places that in the last 10 years, so many people were going there. What sets Lancaster apart from those cities or makes them part of those? Let me ask it that way.
Okay.
What makes them part of that top 10?
You mean to be in the company of...
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I guess you look at Lancaster and you can be downtown, you can eat at a world-class restaurant, have a wonderful cocktail, and then 5 or 10 minutes later, be out in the middle of beautiful farmland. So you look at a Charleston, certainly their downtown is very special, and the history is a big part of that. So you travel out a bit further to explore that part of the destination. There's a lot of different offerings there. They have dining, they have the arts, they have the unique architecture. They have things that really appeal to a wide variety of audiences. Both demographically and psychographically. So I would say Lancaster's the same way that, the Amish makes us very, very unique. And the fact that, we've got the Amish just 10 minutes away from our city is really incredible because you can do so many different experiences in one getaway destination. So I would say the quality of our experiences is just as good, if not better, than the experiences in those other destinations, especially in particular about the Amish. That has evolved as the demographic shifts have changed. People want to interact with the Amish. They don't want to just go and pull off the side of the road and just watch a farm. They want these experiences that nobody else can experience. And you can do that in Lancaster. You can have a VIP experience. So I would say look at the quality of our products and offerings compared to what is available in all these other destinations, and they're right there.
Interact with the Amish? I mean, I'm curious about that because, let's face it, the Amish aren't there to be tourist attractions for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And we know they don't like to get their photograph taken and, they're people.
Correct.
So what kind of interaction is available now that didn't used to be?
Well, for example, a couple years ago, I went on a VIP tour at the Amish Experience. And I think it was about a 3-hour tour. And basically, you get on a small, it's not really a bus, it's just a large van for the most part, but kind of in the middle of a van
it's
or a bus.
It's not a big buggy, though.
No, it's not a big buggy. But basically, and this was a few years ago, but I went to an Amish farm. So we got to talk to a farmer who was showing us how to milk the cows and just, his way of life. We actually went into the house and we were able to sit with a family and just talk to them and ask them questions. And, they answered questions about, well, how can you power your oven and how can you power your refrigerator? Because we didn't think you could use electricity. So we were just able to talk and interact. And then I think the third stop was at an Amish business. So we went to a buggy maker. So it's those types of things that, and again, I've been in this position for 5 years, and I think the VIP experience, this VIP tour started shortly after I started working at Discover Lancaster. So these are the things that, they're paying attention to what people are looking for. They want that authentic experience. And, to be able to interact with such a unique culture is really fascinating.
This portion of the show, we're speaking with Kathleen Frankfurt, president of Discover Lancaster. Forbes.com named Lancaster as one of the top 10 cities across the country, coolest cities across the country to visit in 2018. Tell us what you like about Lancaster. Maybe there are other places in central Pennsylvania you'd like to talk about as well. But 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. UITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. There are many places across the country, across the state, even in our own backyard here in central Pennsylvania, that are trying to use the arts, restaurants, upgrade what they do. If they have waterfronts, that they're trying to take advantage of that, take advantage of the assets that they have. Some have been very successful, like Lancaster, for example. Harrisburg was Second Street with the restaurant Row. You know, I think that there are so many places that you can name. York has done a nice job with the arts as well. So many of them you can name. What has made Lancaster successful, though? I hope I'm not repeating myself, mm-hmm. but when there was so much competition out there to bring visitors to a city like Lancaster, when everyone is, they're not all doing the same thing and doing it the same way, but they have used tourism, they have used restaurant, the arts, theater, those kind of things to bring people in. How is it Lancaster has done it a little more successfully?
Well, I would say in terms of spreading awareness, word of mouth is just key. And in Lancaster, we really know how to take care of our guests. So people come, they have a wonderful experience, and then they're telling other people about their experience and so on and so on. And so you look at the reviews of the different offerings and attractions that we have in Lancaster, and they're very, very high. So certainly that service element has been key. We've also been just so lucky to get some really great, passionate, smart people open businesses here, and they love the area. A lot of people have come from New York, they've come from Philadelphia, and they want to get away from the hustle and bustle, but they still like that urban atmosphere. And I mean, we just have some incredible chefs that have opened restaurants in downtown Lancaster. They're just very, very passionate about it. So it's, they're coming to experience it. What we do really goes beyond tourism, because people come to visit a destination, then they decide to move there. You always visit first. So you decide to move to Lancaster, you fall in love with the area, and then you decide to open a business. And then the more businesses that are available, that just continues that circle of economic development, because you become more attractive to visitors. So I would say that the businesses that I have dealt with and the people who are starting these restaurants and, not even tourism related businesses, coming in and starting tech companies, they're just really passionate. They love what they're doing, and they're very, very excited about what the potential can be in this area.
Let's take a phone call from mm-hmm. Matt. I understand Matt lives in Harrisburg now, but he grew up in Lancaster. Matt, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I'd just like to highlight what I think is an important distinction. There's a lot of discussion on the Amish as a tourist attraction, but I think we could broaden that to agriculture as a whole. I think a lot of people will travel to Lancaster for the same reason they might go to some place like Tuscany for that agricultural experience, not just exclusive to the Amish.
Mm. Thank you very much for your call. And we know Lancaster at one time was known as the garden spot of the world. Mm-hmm. So what do you think of what Matt has to say?
Well, it's interesting, because throughout our research, we've done what we call creative evaluation. So you'll show materials, you'll show TV spots. And when people see the beautiful farmland, they think of the Amish. So he's absolutely right. There are just so many beautiful, beautiful places to experience in Lancaster, and the means by which you can do that, whether it's running a scooter, going on a horse and buggy ride, it's broadened, and it's more available to people to be able to experience that. But absolutely, that's a very special part of our destination, that beauty.
One thing I have to mention that I had thought of right away when Matt talked about agriculture overall mm-hmm. is that there are many, many people who are thinking about buying locally now. And when you talk about agriculture, you mentioned Central Market. Central Market, where you get to see the products that are produced by farmers in Lancaster County, I have to think that is one of the reasons that a lot of people, when they think of Lancaster County, they think of agriculture, they think, oh, I want to buy a product from Lancaster County because I know that this is an area that has a reputation for quality agricultural products.
Absolutely. I mean, you could say that the Amish are really the originators of the whole farm-to-table concept, so that's something that's very important to visitors.
Let's take a call from Elsie in Lancaster. Elsie, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm very pleased with your program. I work at the Mennonite Information Center, and we are just beginning a new showing of a film, 25 minutes long, called The Lancaster Amish. It has great content about the life and spirit practices of the Amish. We also have a 17-minute-long movie called We Believe about the five core values of our Mennonite church. We have tour guides, Mennonite tour guides, who get into your car and take you out into the Amish to experience their life and meet people. So I would like to encourage people to at least learn about the Mennonite Information Center. Wow.
Hey, thank you very much for your call. Kathleen Frankfurt, I want to thank you. We're almost out of time. President of Discover Lancaster, congratulations. And again, there is a link on our website, WITF.org. So be sure to go to it. Kathleen, thank you very much.
Thank you.